But there are some connections, and we thought we might put together a few bits and pieces that illustrate these different kinds of connections. Actually, the relationship is a very old one, and goes back to the time of the Greeks. Some of you, or many of you, may have heard of the Pythagoreans. You've all heard the Pythagorean theorem, I'm sure, which is a bane to some of you in geometry, but a very, very basic and important theorem. Well, the Pythagoreans had as a motto, all is number. They said everything about the world could be described in terms of number. And so they, in looking at the heavens and describing how God created the world and everything else, they used number to do it. They're much enamored with this whole business of number. They had a secret society. And if you disclosed the secrets of this organization, the chances are you would be thrown out, punished severely, and then thrown out of the organization. So it wasn't until after all the Pythagoreans had died that we found out what they'd been talking about. Well, they believed that another important aspect of life was music. And in fact, they really treated music as a kind of category of mathematics. So they studied, for example, the tones you get when you take a string, stretch it, and then pluck it. And it's to them that we owe all of the ratios that describe musical intervals. So, for example, if you take a string that is of length 2 units and another of length 3 units, and then pluck those 2 strings, you get an interval of 1/5. Well, they worked out all of these things. And so it's to them, basically, that we owe this intervals that we know so well in music today. Now, just to skip a little ways down into the future from that point, we come to a rather interesting chap whose name was Johannes Kepler. And just to give this program a little bit of efficacy and validity here at Holden, Kepler was a Lutheran. In fact, he was a very, very intense Lutheran. He was a mystic, and very likely his theology wouldn't quite fit with ours today, but he was nonetheless a devout Lutheran and much caught up in the ideas of the Greeks, the Pythagoreans, and he was also an astronomer. And he's a very important person in astronomy because he was the one who first of all discovered the basic laws that decide how the planets move about the sun. And these laws are still used by astronomers. They're very beautiful laws, very elegant. So he is a key figure in the whole development. Well, he believed that, like the Pythagoreans, that everything could be described in number. And since God, the creator, was, according to Pythagoreans, a geometer, the planets themselves had to be somehow geometrically spaced. And he took 5 basic solids the Greeks worked with, and by putting these one inside the other, tried to describe how the planets separated themselves one from another. He had a second burning belief, and that was that these planets suggested a kind of harmony, because that was a godly attribute as well. Everything God did in the heavens was harmonious. And so he said that the relationships of these various planets somehow had to be tied in with music. And so, by looking at the distances between the planets, the nearest and farthest distances that the Earth came to the sun, and so on, he devised a whole collection of ratios and musical phrases that he associated with each of the planets. And I think Jerry can play a few of these to illustrate the kind of things that that Kepler was doing, and perhaps Jerry has some comments too along that line.
He's very effusive in his writing. He says, there is need for louder sound. While I climb among the harmonic scale of the celestial movements to higher things, where the true archetype of the fabric of the world is kept hidden. Follow after, ye modern musicians, and judge the thing according to your arts, which were unknown to antiquity. Nature, which is never not lavish of herself, after a lying in of 2,000 years, has finally brought you forth in these last generations the first true images of the universe. And then he has, in a very systematic way, given a melodic line to every one of the planets, which I have now found. This is Saturn. This is Jupiter. And this is Mars, approximately. And Earth. And Venus. Believe it.
While I was struggling, this is the first time I've come across this information,
and I found a quote by a man I also have not had occasion to spend much time with, and that his name is Steno, Nicholas Steno, who worked in 1673. And I thought of that quote when I was working with this material that I don't understand. And he said, beautiful is that which we see. More beautiful that which we know. But by far, the most beautiful, that which we do not comprehend. And I thought, of all the times that I could use a quote like that, it would be a funny. Because this man is just absolutely wild about the relationship of what's going on in the outer spheres and putting musical notation to each planet and having this all go on. But the more I worked with it, the more fun I've been having with the music that I know that came after that. I worked with, I'll play a little bit of the Prelude of Bach on the organ later, but he starts out. About each one of those musical phrases as kind of, you know, there they go. Okay, we'll carry on and I'll try to find something else to talk about, all right?
Well, I just had a question, Jerry. Do you know if a composition like Gustav Holst, The Planets, in any way ties in with this kind of idea at all?
I think Holst was trying to give each planet a kind of personality.
Mm-hmm.
In musical phrases. He wasn't as interested in the melodic formulation that mm-hmm. Kepler is. Later on in Kepler's book, he talks about some other aspects of this, and probably it would be clearer if I just read another paragraph. Accordingly, the movements of the heavens, just to give it a little more credibility, I mean, we can say that a person does this, but when you actually can read what he has actually written down in black and white. Accordingly, the movements of the heavens are nothing except a certain everlasting polyphony. I think my concert going is going to be enriched as I sit and stargaze now. Intelligible, not audible. And I went to the stargazing affair that you had out in front of our chalet the other night, you know, and the thought hadn't occurred to me of that as being a polyphony going on up there. A silent, inaudible polyphony. It's a marvelous concept. A polyphony is many, many voices occurring at the same time. Like we could have a little polyphony going on right now. You start. Row, row, row your boat. Row, row, row your boat. Gently down the street. Merrily in the sky.
Okay.
okay, yeah. But then you got that. There's polyphony going on. And when Bach writes a fugue, that's polyphony. We heard the D minor fugue last night. That's polyphony. Okay, all these many voices occurring at the same time, going on, and interacting. But then he says, with dissonant tunings, like certain syncopations and cadences, certain things that happen that are not always going to be in perfect concord. And just like Matins this morning talked about, you know, life isn't all one big joy package. And she talked about the rainbow. Well, so what happens? We have dissonance in music. We have dissonance in life. And those, some of us grow because we've had dissonances in our lives. Heartaches. And they've helped us to grow because God has been with us. But dissonant tunings like certain syncopations or cadences, where men imitate these natural dissonances, which tend toward fixed and prescribed clauses, the single clauses having six terms, like voices. He's just persistent of setting up this relationship. Hence, it is no longer a surprise that man, and what is the definition of man? The ape. The ape of his creator. Should finally have discovered the art of singing polyphonically, which was unknown to the ancients. You see, there was a time when there was no polyphony. And now he's saying, in his period, they're discovering polyphony. And at the same time, they're discovering the heavens, and they're discovering the polyphony in the heavens. There's a marvelous, marvelous growth, marvelous development of insight. In order that he might play the everlastingness of all created time in some short part of an hour by means of an artistic concord of many voices, and that he might, to some extent, taste the satisfaction of God the workman with his own works, in that very sweet sense of delight elicited from this music which imitates God. And then you think of Johann Sebastian Bach 200 years later, and every piece of music he inscribes to the glory of God alone. And that it sort of reflects that order that God puts in the heavens. It's a marvelous relationship. Yes. You'll have to ask Kepler about that. And he's turning over in his grave right now because I'm sure we're misrepresenting him.
If you want to read about this, it's the title of the work is The Harmony of the Spheres. That's the name of the work of Kepler. But it's found in the Great Book series. And it really is a classic and a very famous bit of literature in the in the whole history of the development of science.
I'm not going to read the next paragraph, but the next section starts out by saying, in the celestial harmonies, which planet sings soprano? Which alto? Which tenor and which bass? So, you know, he's really persistent about this, and he must have really had a great time working with this.
I think he did, yeah. Well, maybe we can go on to something else. There is another similarity between math and music that I'd like to point out. Both of them, it seems to me, are quite strong in their are quite strongly represented as symbolic ways of expression. A composer sits down before a piece of paper, staff, and then he uses notation that is special to communicate what he wants to convey. And likewise, in mathematics, we have a large collection of symbols. They don't look like notes, of course, but a large collection of symbols. And these are used to convey what the mathematician wants to say. Now, I think that music is somewhat unique in this respect. You take a painter, for example. He paints on a canvas a scene of some kind, and your apprehension of that is direct. You can see immediately what he is attempting to say. You see the scene visually. But that's not quite the same in music, unless you can hear things in your mind as you look at a score like Beethoven could. Most of us would have to take the musical score and translate that symbolism back into sound before we understood the music. And in the same way in mathematics, we must look at the symbols to catch something of the meaning. And so there is a way in which the two areas relate and overlap in this particular man. Now, to go on to still another idea that's very basic to mathematics, that is the idea of symmetry. Just the other day, Phil Schroeder used a quote from Simone Weil. And she had a brother, Herman, who was a brilliant mathematician. And I believe in the preface of the book that Phil quoted from, there is a statement about the family relationship between Simone and her brother, Herman. It's a very fascinating family, by the way. Anyway, Herman Weil was a very gifted mathematician and wrote extensively on this idea of symmetry. We use symmetry a great deal in mathematics. In geometry, you're familiar with the uses of symmetry to discuss triangles and geometrical figures. And that it doesn't stop there by any means. It's used in more advanced areas of mathematics to establish proofs. And one person that did a great deal with that was Blaise Pascal and also Descartes. They both used this aspect or this idea of symmetry to establish proofs. They would take a theorem and replace certain words with words that had a kind of a counter meaning. Do that throughout the theorem. You get a new theorem that is true, but has been proven essentially only by appealing to a kind of symmetry. And likewise, in other areas of mathematics, the same is done. Now, in music, there is a good deal of expression of symmetry. And Jerry has some examples of these kinds of things. The sonata form, for example, well, Jerry could describe these better than I. ABA, ABA, C, and
we'll
ABA
a,
and
we'll
such.
We'll take a simple, if A stands for this figure. Because music is in time, and because music is not, you know, fixed as that cross, and we just can't look at it. And then you can walk over there and you can look at it. But music is in time. Composers, to help us, repeat figures over and over again. But they also set up this this idea of symmetry. And one of the simplest symmetrical ideas is an ABA form. I remember watching the television transcript of Leonard Bernstein's program on what is sonata form. And when he was talking about ABA, he said, ABA is just as simple as looking at the mirror when you're shaving in the morning and saying, this is A, this is B, and this is A. Or it's something like the tree. You know, here's the branch, here's the trunk, here's the branch, that's A, here's B, and here's A. So ABA, that's what we're working with, ABA structure. And here, there's one candle is A, the dancing servant is B, and there's A. There's just symmetry all around us. And so there is in music. There's a delightful symmetry. There's a balance. And in a minuet, which is a dance form, there is a balance. And this is one of the Bach minuets that he wrote for his wife. Back to the E again.
And if you can understand APA form, then you can understand just about all the music that's ever been written in the classical period, anyway, and the Baroque period, and the Romantic period, and much of the modern period. Okay, I don't know if I should go into an exhaustive analysis of sonata form, but the same thing applies, only it gets a little bit more involved. And instead of just having that one theme, as we had in the minuet, we have two themes now. First theme is this.
This is the Beethoven sonata.
You can listen to a Beethoven symphony 25 times and never exhaust, you know. There's always some new relationship that you begin to see. Well, that development, now, you can see that. He works through that development, and then he will come back again to... Now we're in the third act. Intellectual, I like to call it, intellectual grace. Okay? I might, as long as I have the floor, just talk, I have no idea. He might take over for the rest of the period. And I do have these two marvelous quotes from Martin Luther that come from the Lutheran Society for Worship, Music, and the Arts bulletin. And one says, we find a noteworthy statement in his celebrated letter to the aldermen and cities of Germany to erect and maintain Christian schools. And this is dear Father Martin writing. Since youth must skip about and leave, boy, those Germans really must have been a pretty lively crew, or at least do something that affords pleasure, and since it would certainly not do to forbid this entirely, ought we not to furnish schools in which we could teach youth such art? By the grace of God, everything is so arranged today that children are able to learn with pleasure, even while they play, not only the languages, but also the arts and history. I say for myself, if I had children, this is before he did, and would be able to carry it out, I would insist that they study not only languages and history, but also, and now look at the language, singing, instrumental, music, and all mathematics. Luther had that idea kind of linking those two. Is this not all child's play through which the Greeks in former times trained their children, who developed into men and women of remarkable ability, fit for every eventuality of life? Well, so Martin Heth. But Martin, the quote I really wanted to share with you is his delightful description of polyphony, notes dancing around. Sorry. I, Dr. Martin Luther, with all lovers of the unshackled art of music, grace and peace from God the Father and from our Lord Jesus Christ, I truly desire that all Christians would love and regard as worthy the lovely art of music. Parenthetically, I would say, you know, what are you doing in your parish budget? Which is a precious, worthy, and costly treasure given mankind by God. The riches of music are so excellent and so precious that words fail me. So what is he writing so much about? That words fail me whenever I attempt to discuss and describe them. Next to the word of God, the noble art of music is the greatest treasure in this world. It controls our thoughts, minds, hearts, and spirits. Our dear fathers and prophets did not desire without reason that music be always used in churches. Hence we have so many songs and psalms. This precious gift has been given to man alone that he might thereby remind himself of the fact that God has created man for the express purpose of praising and extolling God. However, when man's natural musical ability is whetted and polished to the extent that it becomes an art, and we heard some of that last night, then do we note with great surprise the great and perfect wisdom of God in music, which is, after all, his product and his gift. We marvel when we hear music in which one voice, and now we get into this polyphonic idea, we marvel when we hear music in which one voice sings a simple melody, while three, four, or five other voices play and trip lustily around the voice that sings its simple melody and adorn this simple melody wonderfully with artistical musical effects, thus reminding us of heavenly dance. You see, even Martin would feel comfortable within this framework, which all meet in a spirit of friendliness, caress, and embrace. A person who gives this thought and yet does not regard it, music, as a marvelous creation of God must be a clodhopper. Indeed, and does not deserve to be called a human being. He should be permitted to hear nothing but the braying of asses and the grunting of hogs. Oh, he really did say that.
And a lot of other things.
It's best we not quote Luther too much. He's a very earthy fellow.
There is another aspect of this whole idea of symmetry that is interesting. I don't know if we have any examples of it, but Mozart, from time to time, played around with music and did some things that are really, in a way, mathematical. He would write scores which were such that if you flipped the paper over, you could play it that way as well. And there are phrases, I think, in Mozart also, which you can play backwards, and you'll get a sensible musical phrase. Well, these, in a sense, are likewise mathematical ideas. And another aspect of music that relates to mathematics is that of canon, where you have a melody coming in, and then later on down the line, the same melody appearing. You know, you have one melody, the same melody following itself, in a sense. And this likewise has many examples in mathematics. If you're an electrical engineer, you know what phase difference means in terms of electrical current. And there are many other places in mathematics where this kind of repetition appears. Do you have any examples of that, Jerry?
Well, that whole idea of phase, I started going through some of the Bach literature, and I decided that Bach must have been an electrical engineer too, when we were talking about that. In several of his prelates and fugues, this is one of the early ones, he has this idea of a major layer comes in the tenor line.
Thank you.
most of you are familiar with, or many of you at least, have seen descriptions of sound waves, which are smooth, undulating waves. If you take two of these, or one of them, and then shift one a bit to the side, you have two of them running together, but they don't peak at the same time. When that happens, we say the waves are out of phase. They reach their climaxes at different times. Otherwise, the one is simply a pattern of the other. They're identical, really, but they're just not concurrent. Well, that same kind of thing happens here in music in many places.
Can you hear that as a mathematician?
Can I what?
Can you hear a phase? Is this do you feel that that's justified in calling this phase music?
Well, not exactly, but one aspect of symmetry that is this matter of taking a particular pattern and then shifting it repeatedly down the line to get a whole sequence of those patterns. So in wallpaper, for example, you have a particular pattern that's repeated over and over again. Or in a frieze at the top of a building, let's say, you have this kind of repeating of a pattern. That is an aspect of symmetry.
Well, and this would be in the box, in major five, it goes like this.
One could say about this notion of symmetry in music, but I'd like to go on to something else. I think that one thing that has entered into mathematics in the modern times quite significantly is the whole study of chance and statistics, where we look at occurrences and try to ascertain how frequently they will occur. We look at physics these days from a statistical point of view, and many of the laws, or all the laws of physics for that matter, are seen as the results of statistical studies. The sun rises every day, according to physicists at least, because the probability is so high that it will. Now, this particular character of the of nature as seen by physicists and as studied by mathematicians expresses itself in some music. Musicians have taken up this idea and have tried to build into their music something of this element of chance. Some years ago, I went to a program at Washington State where one of the fellows on the music faculty was describing things he was doing along this line. It wasn't exactly computer music, but he would do things like randomly placing on the strings of the piano weights that would dull certain tones. And then he would play his music on the piano and get a quite different sound. And another thing he did was to take a passage from Tom Sawyer. Like that. He got some weird sounds. He would tape these, and then he would put two or three tapes together and build something else out of that. Another thing he did was to take a paragraph from Tom Sawyer, and then he would assign to various letters certain tones. And from a paragraph of Tom Sawyer would get a little musical composition. Of course, it didn't really hang together very well, but nonetheless, he liked to do that kind of thing, and he felt it had some significance or meaning to express perhaps the kind of randomness and chance and surprises that we all encounter in daily life. Well, modern-day musicians have carried this idea much further and have begun to use computers to devise music. One thing, for example, they do is to take a computer and use it to generate random numbers. Suppose you take a set of all numbers, that's a big set, believe me, and then pick out randomly different numbers. Well, a musician might, for example, assign to any given number by some reduction process so that out of the infinite collection of numbers you get a finite collection of notes and other instructions like loudness and duration. Let the computer generate the random numbers, and then use these to construct a musical sequence. This is computer music, and some very, very weird and strange things, as you well know, can come out of this. So that they don't disobey all of the laws of music, they will use computers likewise to filter out any kinds of harmonies that break the laws of music, so that you don't get things that are really against all the laws of composition. And then they get something that expresses this randomness, this element of chance that we find in nature, and likewise, presumably, expresses something of our feelings about life at times, when we sense somewhat the insecurity of life and the precariousness that we all meet from time to time. I don't know what we can do by way of examples there. They're hard to come by, aren't they, Jerry? Do you have any comments along that line? Yeah. Right. To most of it, you know, it's not melodic music, but some people are very much...
I was with John Cage just a few months ago at the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis, and he's an avant-garde contemporary musician, and he had written a composition in which he left out tones of hymns. So, for example, Praise to the Lord would be... Fill in the missing parts. You know, we're all sitting there at the edge. But that was his way of... there's also another composer who had a deck of cards, and on the deck of cards he had written phrases, musical phrases, and then they shuffled the deck and then they passed out, and that was the music. And then, every time you hear that composition, maybe the oboe would play this figure one time, and the tuba would play this figure, and then the next time the oboe would play this figure, and the tuba would play. You never knew what was going to happen from that.
I mentioned Mozart earlier. He liked to dabble in these things somewhat. He, at one time, took a collection of musical phrases, of measures of music, and associated with each of those a number that you might get by rolling dice. And then he rolled the dice and used that to choose the order of these various measures and constructed a piece of music in that manner. Now, I don't have the score is not around, otherwise, Jerry, I'm sure I could play that for you. But that perhaps is the earliest, that's the earliest example of that kind of thing that I have heard of. But many very bizarre things are done in this area using tape recorders and other electronic generators of sound, as an organ like this really is too. It's an electronic organ and uses electronic circuitry to produce the sound.
There's another aspect of the relationship between music and math, mathematics, that I'd like to just give you a smattering of ignorance about, and that is this whole area of numerology, especially as applied to Johann Sebastian Bach. And to get us started in that, some scholars have said that Bach planned and designed compositions that he wrote to work with some numbers that had special significance for his name. To do this, we'll have to add together a little bit. If A equals 1 and B equals 2, let's add up what we get for the number. We don't have a blackboard here, but we can pretend we have one. A is 2. I mean, that is his first name, Bach. B is 2. A is 1. That's 3. Where have you gone to school? She's to see all. And C is ABC. That's 3, 6. Oh, you're all right. All right, excuse me. That'll be it. B, A, C, and then H is what? A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H. 8 plus 6 is 14. So, firmly, will you front row remember that? I'll say 14. Don't forget that. All right. Now we take the first initial of his first name. His first name was Johann. So the first initial is. However, we have to make a little adjustment. And I have not studied 18th century German, but they tell me that in the 18th century German language, H and I is
that I and J.
I and J. Excuse me. I and J are the same. So here we go. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J. So that'd be how many? 9. Okay, then the second name is?
Sebastian.
So that's A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S. 18, and what was the other figure? What's 18 and 9? 27. Add 27, and what's your number? 27 and 14, what do you get? Oh, did he ever love that? Have you got it? 14 and 41? Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay, now that becomes very, you know, kooky. And you begin to wonder, is it really true? And then you start studying the Bach scores, and you find that to the... Sinfonia, for one of his cantatas, it had 14 majors. 14 majors. And as though he was just signing his name, B-A-C-H, in numbers. 14 majors. And I have, I used to teach a course in music to non-music majors. And I always, you know, just you know, trying to find those areas that would interest the mathematicians and the chemists and the physicists and so forth. And they always would perk up. There was not anybody sleeping during that lecture. When we talk about numerology and Bach, I would hope now that they would be sitting there counting majors when they're listening. No, I don't mean that. But I would hope they'd have more interest in Bach after they've worked with numerology. But the most eerie aspect of this whole numerology Bach is the story that I think it's Leonard Bernstein again that relates at the in his book called The Joy of Music, when he's giving a television one of his television spectaculars on Johann Sebastian Bach, and he recounts how on the deathbed of Bach, and I mentioned this on our session on funeral music the other day, on the deathbed of Bach, and I can't remember, obviously, I haven't died yet. But I would think that when you reach the point, you really wouldn't know for sure that you're dying. But it's very interesting. Bach knew he was dying. And it's evident by the fact that he called in his son-in-law. And he said to his son-in-law, I would like to dictate to you some music.
And so he said, I want it to be with text, though. And the text he chose for the composition was, Before Thy Throne I Now Appear. Good Lutheran theology. Strong affirmation of faith. Before Thy Throne I Now Appear. And then they took that melody for that hymn. And it didn't have the prescribed number of notes, so he embellished a few of the notes. So it had a few extra notes, like, and the total number of notes gets for the whole melody for that last work of Johann Sebastian Bach is 41. And when you get back home, you can go into the library and start looking up numerology and start working with that whole issue of Bach and numerology, and you can just find countless examples. You know, the use of threes for the Trinity, the use of 10 for the law, the use of 12 for the apostles. Is it I? Is it I? Is it I? Is it I? Is it St. Matthew Passion? 11 times. Judas notably absent. But he's very interested in that whole aspect of numerology.
I think that's conscious.
I
thought it was deliberate.
I just can't see how it could be anything but other but conscious. Because if it was just one example, but I have come across I could supply at least out of the Bach compositions, 55 to 65 examples of similar 14 and 41 examples. The evidence is just so overwhelming in favor of that ordered mind of Bach. But to understand a mind that is as complex as Bach is not to understand. You just can't understand it. But I think that probably existed. There was one other error. Yes. Definitely. Yes.
Free.
Yes. There's a whole new system of notation today. In fact, there are books now, not only on how on music, but whole books on just notation, because the notation has changed so much. Yeah. And it for example, set your stopwatch for a minute, and then or 30 seconds or 20 seconds, and do this figure. Or something like that. And then you change it to another figure. Oh, there's eventually comes order. I think that sometimes there comes some order, and maybe somebody someday will try to pin it down. There's one other area that we were going to close with. There are two ways I would like to close. One way, the way we talked about closing, and then the other way. but let's do the way we talked about closing and see how long that takes, and then we can have a coda. We talked about closing about electronic music, and that brings us into that. And there is a contemporary American composer, Felciano. It's very interesting. I became better acquainted with him because I know Paul Christensen's son, Sigurd, down at Texas, Lutheran. And he did his doctoral thesis on Felciano. And I thought it was kind of interesting that the grandson of F. Melius Christensen, who wrote Beautiful Xavier, should be doing his doctoral thesis on Felciano and electronic music. We've come a long, long way in terms of change in music. But Felciano was very interested in the priest. Who did he discuss?
Chardin.
Teilhard de Chardin, right. And if you know anything about Chardin, you know that he has a very positive outlook about the world, and he also is thinking in futures. And the title of the composition is for pipe organ. I just love to play the piece because I never have to practice it. It's one note, and you just pull out the stops and get louder and louder and louder, and then you set the tape machine going, and the tape plays, and it has all these bleeps and bloops, and the title of the composition is God of the Expanding Universe. It's very memorable, and it gets louder and louder and louder, you add more and more stops, and the bleeps get more and more, and then it goes the other way. And it's kind of an AVA form, really, not in melodic content, but in dynamic play. It starts very soft, it's louder and louder and louder and louder, and then it fades away, and then you go beyond noise. God of the Expanding Universe. And you have some interesting ideas about expanding universe. I don't understand that.
I'm not sure anybody does, really, but
that's best.
there is one of the surprises in astronomy a number of years ago was that the universe appears to be expanding. And this has been determined by looking at stars and observing what is called red shift. If you stand by the railroad track and listen to an approaching train, you'll discover that the pitch of the whistle seems to increase as the train moves toward you. And then as the train moves away from you, the pitch decreases. Well, it's as if the signal of the whistle or the waveform is being compressed as the train moves toward you, and that corresponds to a higher pitch. And likewise, as the train moves away, the waveform is stretched out and we have a lower pitch. Well, astronomers saw this happening to light, that a number of the bodies they observed in the heavens displayed this so-called red shift, or a shift of the light spectrum toward the red end. That means lower frequencies. And hence they deduced from that the objects were receding from us. And they have found that the farther you go out into the universe, the faster the objects are receding from us. So that the entire universe is as a clump of dough, you might say, that is rising because of the effect of yeast. Every point is moving farther and farther away from all the other points that are found in the universe. And this is a very mystifying idea. But astronomers have tried to grope with it, tried to deal with it, and Einstein tried to describe it as in terms of a curved space, that this space that seems to be expanding eventually curves back upon itself. And so if you look through a telescope, you see at some object, why, eventually, if your vision is good enough, you see the back of your head. Well,
now that we've come full circle, I will end the way we were not going to end by saying, while I struggle, this is Kepler, while I struggle to bring forth this process into the light of human intelligence, I would also like that the people might be in concord with the body of the Holy Church, and they may be built up on earth as thou didst erect the heavens themselves. Have a nice call.
Thank you.